On June 5, 1981, federal health officials issued a report about five young gay men in Los Angeles struck with a rare form of pneumonia, usually limited to people with failed immune systems. It was the first formal mention of the disease now known as acquired immune deficiency syndrome, or AIDS. 30 years later, the virus that caused AIDS has infected more than 60 million people worldwide and killed nearly half that number. Although infection with the human immunodeficiency virus, or HIV, is no longer the death sentence it once was, thanks to the availability of drugs to suppress it, with more than 56,000 new HIV infections in the United States each year, the AIDS epidemic is far from over. And despite better treatments, there is still no cure. And significant hurdles remain in eradicating the disease. Joining us this morning to discuss the current state of treatment and prognosis for this disease are Dr. Donald Blair, a professor of medicine at Upstate Medical University and the medical director of Upstate's designated AIDS Center, and nurse practitioner Judith Rees, who is the program director of the designated AIDS Center at Upstate. Welcome to you both. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Blair, let's start first with a very brief history of AIDS. It started 30 years ago in this country. Can you remind us how it came to this country?
We know more about that now than we used to, of course. The virus originated in West Africa in the tropical forest from mutation from a chimpanzee virus. It spread worldwide through people as they spread to various areas, and there's lots of details about that, but it arrived in the United States, don't know for sure when, but probably as early as 1968, maybe even earlier, and spread initially through men who have sex with men and IV drug use or injecting drug use. When a person with a lot of the virus circulating in their blood has sex with or shares needles with somebody else, then the virus is very easily spread. And it did spread rapidly over the entire United States. This first came to our attention in that report you alluded to, which was a condition called pneumocystis pneumonia. And that was very puzzling. It rapidly became clear that those weren't the only risk groups, and blood products were added to the list.
So our blood supply was at risk.
Our blood supply was definitely at risk, and there were thousands of cases of transmittal through blood product transfusions. That got cleaned up fairly quickly, but we didn't have a test until April of 1985.
Wow.
And so the screening of blood was delayed, and the identification of infected people was delayed until we had a good test.
But we had virtually no treatment. Is that right, Judy? And basically there was nothing to do.
There was no treatment. And the very first treatment, AZT or Retrovir, was not developed for HIV. Actually, it was already on the... It had been developed and was shelved because there was no use for it. So when this happened in the late 80s, we had to apply to Bowers Welcome to get the drug for a single person, have it shipped to pharmacies, so there was equity in how the available drug was distributed.
But basically, people were just dying. I mean, it was a death sentence.
What we were seeing was the end of a very long disease. Not when we started treating, it was too late.
And there were also few treatments for the opportunistic infections, such as the pneumocystis. Is that correct as well?
Well, the treatment for the opportunistic infections, or OIs as referred to them, that progressed pretty rapidly.
Okay.
With pneumocystis, it was learned that Bactrim and other related drugs would treat that. There were several others. And for some of the mycobacteria, the cousins of tuberculosis, treatment was progressed rapidly, and toxoplasmosis and cryptococcosis, all these what sound like esoteric diseases became very, very common then.
They're much
less common now. Yeah, with people who had progressive ruining of their immune system by HIV.
Right. Was it able to quell the progression of the disease at that point, or no? Back then,
single drug therapy really wasn't able to do that. We knew that we needed combination therapies, drugs in different classes. It really wasn't until 1996, when the protease inhibitors came out, that there was a significant change and real hope with treatment.
So it took how many years then? It took about 12, 15 years?
Well, the virus is actually identified in late 83 or early 84. And so it was about 12 to 13 years after that, which is probably the most rapid that any viral disease has been explicated to that degree and some treatment developed for it. It's really remarkable.
It was working. They were working kind of across the pond as well, as I understood.
Everywhere, yes.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Throughout the world, basically.
The virus was probably discovered in France mm-hmm. by Luc Montagnier. Mm-hmm. And yes, it's been an international effort.
It remains that, I understand, in terms of the treatment, because it's still a global epidemic.
Yes.
And we'll get to mm-hmm. talking about that in a bit. But how did it change the way we viewed some things like contact sports, for example, or hospital methodology, safety precautions in hospitals? Because I know the issue is it's blood-related. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's carried in the blood.
More precisely, it's blood and body fluid-related. For example, mother's milk is quite contagious, and other body fluids. Do you want to?
I think that the issue of contact sports still comes up, and it's a what if these two people had some sort of contact and one was bleeding and you have an open area. Still, the virus still has to get inside of someone. So in and of itself, the blood or body fluids being present, it has to get inside of the other person.
So those precautions that were instituted then are still being instituted
right.
today.
Well,
we have to take a short break. We have a lot more to talk about. I want to go into all the treatments that are available. But we'll be right back, so please stay right there. I'm Linda Cohen. This is HealthLink on Air, FM News Radio 106.9 and 570 WSYR. Back to HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen, along with my guest Dr. Donald Blair and nurse practitioner Judith Rees, and we're talking about HIV/AIDS 30 years later from the first cases reported in this country and where we stand today. Now, people can be treated, but they still die from the disease. I mean, I mentioned in the beginning we have 56,000 new cases in the United States annually, so obviously it's still ever present.
Mm-hmm.
What do we need to do? I mean, what seems to be, well, first I want to get to the treatments, but before that, what would you say we need to do?
Testing.
Okay, tell me about that.
Testing early and testing often. So many, many people don't get tested. The number one reason they say they don't get tested is because my healthcare provider didn't ask me to. So we have to turn the impetus to get tested onto the healthcare system and not to the patients.
Okay, and what would testing do besides treating the individual patient? I think it's a larger public health issue. Is that correct?
Right, and early treatment would help to reduce the amount of virus and hopefully reduce the efficacy of transmission. So earlier treatment, earlier diagnosis and treatment, we could quell the episode.
And this actually has been shown in a public health study out in the Northwest, where they intensified the testing and they saw the new infection rate drop.
Well, that's
so
significant.
So education has been of uncertain value. Well, obviously, we have to educate, but educating people who take great risks is extremely difficult, whereas testing does at least uncover some that will then cooperate and get their viral load lowered.
But clearly that they need to then be apprised of the fact that they are a carrier, is that correct?
Exactly.
And then they would hopefully not engage in behaviors that would infect a partner.
And enough do behave, just like you said, that it does make a difference in the spread of the virus. That's now been demonstrated.
And there's a new law in New York State here locally, I mean in New York, so tell us about that.
Well, it actually went into effect September 1st last year, the regulations are not finished yet.
Oh.
So some people are already instituting it, and it's a great start. Unfortunately, what the law says is that everyone should be needs to be tested once between the ages of 13 and 64. Well, that really
That's very broad.
It's not going to do it. So what we're hoping is that this will become a standard of care, a standard of treatment for everybody's annual physicals or visits to the emergency room. Already, several new cases have been referred to us from local prompt cares. They offered the test to people coming in for such things as fractures.
Oh, really?
And they were positive. And these were unknown positives.
Unknown, obviously, to them.
Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating. But is there an issue with privacy? I mean, obviously, it does. This has always been raised in terms of the privacy. And obviously, you have HIPAA standing there to protect the patient. But
yeah, I don't think the issues of privacy are, legally at least, are very little different now with the HIPAA laws. But it's always been an issue, and there's a substantial fear of patients still that their diagnosis be found out. And a lot of people do try to maintain secrecy, which is difficult. And we do our best in the clinic to honor their wishes. But
once diagnosed, I understand that, but I'm thinking about this notion of trying to, in a very large-scale way, test people
when they
come in for an annual physical.
Well,
I mean, it would seem that some patients might resist from the standpoint
all
of
they have
privacy.
To do is say no.
They have the right to say no.
They can opt out.
Okay, so it's not that the law is now making it a mandatory thing.
The law is simply that it must be offered.
Yeah.
Okay. Tell us about the treatments. What's being offered? You mentioned AZT. I know there's a concept of a drug cocktail.
We started with a series of single drugs, a whole series, AZT, 3TC, D4T, DDI. And then we went to combinations of two of them as they became available. And out of the results of the two double drug therapy, then when the protease inhibitors became available, we went to three. And that's the one that got dubbed the cocktail. We never called it that, but in the popular press, that's what it became. We call it highly active therapy, or now they're calling it combined ART, antiretroviral therapy. We've got 20-some products on the market now, and actually treatment is, for the compliant patient, the one who's adherent to treatment.
Who uses the drugs, who takes
right,
the drugs
takes
regularly.
Them and takes them as scheduled.
Mm-hmm.
Suppression of the disease is always possible.
It's interesting because I understand that some of the drugs actually target the virus and others prevent it from entering the cells. Is that true?
Yes, but from our perspective, they're all the same.
I see.
All those are the same. They have about five or six present classes of drugs based on the targets. And one of them is the attachment and the fusion with the cell. Another is the final step. That's the protease inhibitor. So there's a variety of targets.
Isn't there a danger, though, in the fact that of late, excuse me, people have this idea now that it's no problem if I get HIV/AIDS? So we have these drugs. Tell me about that.
I think the general perception is that this is a treatable disease, which it is. It is a very, very difficult disease to treat. And if people start medication and stop, what we're dealing with now is resistant virus. So it's the same issue as we had with antibiotics, people stopping and starting and developing resistance. Well, we're having the same thing with antiretrovirals. We're seeing people that are brand newly diagnosed who may already be resistant to some of the best drugs we have.
Wow.
Because they've been infected by a virus that has resistance.
That's amazing. So and we really do, that's a very significant fact.
Big issue.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How about the side effects from the drug?
Side effects of huge range. Some people do not experience them. For the most part, starting someone on therapy has to be a decision between the patient and the provider. Lethargy, vomiting, diarrhea, very, very common.
So this is not a walk in the park.
It's not.
Which is, I think, unfortunately, become a little bit of the public perception of HIV/AIDS, that it's no longer going to be the death sentence it was.
And unfortunately, it's the perception of the members of the groups that still engage in a risky behavior. Doesn't matter too much what mainstream believe about that kind of thing, but when an increased unprotected sexual activity has been well demonstrated everywhere, really, but formally out in San Francisco area.
There's another very, very disturbing perception that people who now know they can live a long time with this, while they may be in their 50s and 60s and say, I'm sick and tired of all this prevention, and they don't, so I can live 20 or 30 years with or without the virus, and they engage in risky behaviors and are becoming positive.
And then spreading. Continuing to spread the disease, which is what you say. Yes. So what's interesting to me is you say education doesn't really seem to make a difference.
I don't think I really said that. It's been difficult to show what the impact of education is.
And it is
difficult to be enthusiastic about that as our major effort. I think it has certainly failed to meet our expectations of it. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't seem to modify behavior for those who engage in high-risk behavior.
So exactly who are the carriers these days? I mean, or who are currently afflicted?
Well, I think that, you know, despite all the great science and treatment and whatnot, we're trying to keep up with, social media is playing a huge part in young...
New cases
that are hooking up online, anonymous sex or multiple. Mm-hmm. Also, drug use is huge and it alters the perceptions of people engaging in behaviors.
How about with IV? That's no longer a problem.
It's not as big a problem as the heterosexual spread or the men having sex with men spread. Particularly if you have needle exchange programs.
Okay, and that's been instituted in
a lot of places.
Centers.
That has made a very big difference, and that does not seem to be taken lightly by that population.
Mm-hmm.
But the heterosexual spread from drug users and from bisexual activity continues.
Can women transmit the disease as well as men?
Yes, they can.
Mm-hmm. I don't think that's as well known a fact. That's not totally true, because I guess prostitutes were known to be.
Yeah, but it's more than just prostitutes. It's, any woman who's infected any woman who's infected, period, can spread it to a male sex partner. Spread from woman to woman has been reported, but very, very rare.
Mm-hmm.
Very rare.
But clearly women who are pregnant and then give birth can spread it to their
children. That's the most protected group, because their laws were in earlier to test the infant and then the mothers, and the still at risk is the infected woman who comes in without prenatal care.
Mm.
And Judy has dealt with this a great deal.
Well, tell me, so overall, would you say that to beat the epidemic, both here and worldwide, I mean, what are some of the obstacles that we face? Obviously, funding has got to be one, and...
I think, again, to go back to testing.
Well, unfortunately, we're running out of time. There's so much more I'd love to ask you about this, but we have a program here at Upstate. Just tell us very briefly.
Designated AIDS Center. That's all we do. We treat. Right now we have a current patient for 900 patients we're treating. And
it's a clinic setting?
Pardon me?
A clinic setting.
Clinic setting. We provide social work. We provide mental health, women's health.
Is there financial assistance for it?
New York State is funded through Medicaid and through ADAP or private insurance.
Wonderful. Well, Dr. Donald Blair and nurse practitioner Judith Rees, thank you so much for coming in today and to help us understand where we're at with AIDS. We have to take another short break, but we'll be right back, so please stay right there. I'm Linda Cohen. This is HealthLink on Air, FM News Radio, 106.9 and 570 WSYR.